Hello and welcome to Switch Your Money On from Hargreaves Lansdowne. I'm Susanna Streeter, Head of Money and Markets.
And I'm Sarah Coles, Head of Personal Finance.
Really great to be with you and out of the house, Sarah, with a different look at the world of money to the one I'm subjected to most days. Request to increase the pocket money or find odd jobs for my teenage sons to do. They are at that tricky stage of not quite being old enough for a proper job, but still wanting to spend dosh on going out.
I know, I have one of those in my house too, and demands are coming thick and fast, particularly when it comes to driving lessons.
Now, one of the strategies is to find things in the house that they can sell, including the drawer of doom, where all the discarded tech lurks, and the potential resale value of it all has got me thinking about the rising price of metals that we've seen recently.
Yes, gold in particular soared spectacularly and broke new records during the past few weeks.
So, in this edition of the podcast, it seems super timely, for many reasons, to take a deep dive into what's driven metals prices up in an episode we're calling The Gold Rush.
We'll look at how some of the biggest listed names in mining are faring with Sophie Lund-Yates, our lead equity analyst, and we'll get a wide view of the sector and the ESG implications with our investment analyst, Matt Britzman.
Plus, if you were wondering, like my son, about the price of scrap or precious metal, we'll have all the answers with our special guest on the programme today, Scott Butler from Material Focus and the people behind Recycle Your Electricals. So, Scott, I imagine you could work wonders with the drawer of doom in my house.
Yeah, the drawer of doom. The one thing that unites pretty much every household in the UK is that we've got a stash of old tech. We're not quite sure what to do with it. It might be held on to because it's got, you know, our first mobile phone. It's cables for things that we have no idea what they're charging, but our instinct is the second we get rid of them, we'll find the thing. But the truth is, we were all holding on to too much tech. 880 million items are hoarded in the UK. And if you combine that up with the stuff that we're regretfully binning and not recycling, we think around £1 billion worth of metal value is stored in our homes, in our drawers of doom or our garages of garbage.
Well, Scott, thank you very much. And I look forward to finding out more about the value of my drawer of doom a little bit later in the podcast. We'll also be talking to Emma Wall, our head of investment analysis and research, for a fund manager perspective. But first of all, it does make sense to take stock of just where metals prices have been heading recently and why. First off, gold. It's been on a glittering rally for weeks now. It's mainly to do with its perception as a safe haven asset. As geopolitical risks intensified with violence in the Middle East spreading, it sparked a surge in interest in the precious metal.
Yeah, so gold has been in demand as a hedge against inflation too, with the price spiral in the US proving particularly stubborn. So the latest US Consumer Price Index, which is the CPI, that data shows that inflation climbed from 3.2% in February to 3.5% in March, which is likely to keep eroding people's purchasing power. And as the threat of sustained inflation looms, investors have increasingly turned to gold, which has driven up demand and pushed prices higher. It's worth touching on what investors mean by gold being an inflation hedge. So the idea is that at times of higher inflation, bonds are less attractive because the income they pay doesn't keep up with inflation. As a result, investors shift from cash and bonds into other assets, including gold. And this pushes the price of gold up so it keeps pace with inflation. There are several periods over which this has happened, including 2022, but it's not guaranteed because an awful lot of other things affect the gold price.
Yes, and on top of this, more recently, as the gold price has moved higher, it's drawn in more speculators who are hoping to capitalise on future price increases. Meanwhile, central bank buying action has also been driving the price of gold upwards. The latest data from the World Gold Council shows that central banks' activity in increasing gold reserves grew for the 16th month in a row in February, with China the largest buyer, followed by Kazakhstan, India and Turkey. China's consumers have also shown a voracious appetite for gold, with the purchase of jewellery, bars and coins swelling to record levels last year. With China's stock markets floundering and deflation a worry, a growing number of younger Chinese investors are putting their savings into gold, and not just traditional bars or adornments, but little gold beans, pea-sized pieces which weigh about a gram, seen as an entry point of getting exposure. Expectations of central bank rate cuts have also partly boosted the appeal of gold.
So it's also worth saying that the price has slipped back a little as expectations grew that higher interest rates may have to linger for longer, especially in the US. So the issue with higher interest rates is that they make government bonds like US treasuries more appealing. Meanwhile, gold loses its luster because one of the major drawbacks of gold is that it doesn't pay any income at all. Nevertheless, gold is still hovering pretty close to record highs. And as it benefited from a big bull run, it's prompted a rueful look in the UK about what happened to our gold reserves.
Yes, around 25 years ago, on the 7th of May 1999, Gordon Brown, the then Chancellor, announced the intention for the Bank of England to sell off half the nation's gold holdings. The idea was that this would strengthen the nation's reserves by diversifying and reducing the proportion held in gold. Back then, gold was deep in a bear market, having lost 80% of its value from a peak in 1980. Other central banks had indicated they were planning similar, though smaller moves. But signalling the intention to sell such a large sum came in for significant criticism, not least because the price of gold fell around 10% by the time of the first auction in July. In total, the Bank of England offloaded 395 tonnes of gold on the Treasurer's behalf with an average of $276 per troy ounce and made a total of $3.5 billion. The money raised is thought to have been used to purchase US government debt to diversify the nation's reserves. Adjusted for inflation, the gold sold off would be worth just over $20 billion. In comparison, the same amount, $3.5 billion invested in 10-year treasuries and adjusted for inflation over the same period, would be worth just under $5 billion. So it was, at the very least, a decision which cost $15 billion.
Oh, I wonder if he'd make the same decision today. Although, to be fair, you can't predict the trajectory of metals prices. Take lithium, for example. With the advent of electric vehicles, demand for this essential metal, vital for the manufacture of EV batteries, surged, with a great lithium boom erupting between 2021 and 2022. But rather than continuing its upward trajectory, the price then tanked as sales unexpectedly went off the boil, particularly in China.
After sinking to a low in July 2022, copper prices have also rebounded, with an added surge arriving since February this year. It's been pushed sharply higher amid concerns about supply risks at mines and also improving prospects for the metal's use in the energy transition. Expected higher demand for copper will likely have been one of the reasons behind mining giant BHP's unsolicited bid for Anglo American. It was not back, with Anglo saying the bid was opportunistic. It stressed that it's positioned to create significant value from its portfolio of high-quality assets that are well-aligned with the energy transition and other major demand trends. With copper representing 30% of Anglo American's total production, the company said that the board believes Anglo American's shareholders stand to benefit from what we expect to be significant value appreciation as the full impact of those trends materialises. I think it's going to be, though, watch this space. As you never know, another bid could emerge. We'll be chatting to Sophie Lund-Yates about this in a moment.
Silver has also been shining more brightly, as like gold, silver is seen as a stable asset during periods of high geopolitical tensions.
Yes, it's also seen as a hedge against inflation, offering shelter against the erosion of purchasing power, given that its supply is inherently limited. However, it retreated from three-year highs towards the end of the month as global risk aversion receded. So there are clearly challenges as well as opportunities for the mining sector. But what about the opportunities in our own homes? Well, I think this is a really good time to bring back in our guest on the programme today, Scott Butler from Material Focus, who's still with us. So, Scott, we talked about the draw of doom earlier and just how much there is lying around unrecycled. Why do you think people just aren't spotting the potential treasure that's left lying around?
We think around 40% of the UK are currently recycling all of their electricals, which is great. And our Recycle Your Electricals campaign is trying to increase that, make it more normal. But the other behaviours are probably driven by a bit of uncertainty. So we've got tech that we will hold on to because we might need it in the future, or it's a cable that charges something, we're not quite sure what it is, or it's a spare mobile phone, or it's a digital camera which might have images on it. That's the kind of stuff that goes into the drawer. the drawer of doom, as it's sometimes called, but it's actually a drawer of hidden treasures there. Then you've got the stuff that's easily binnable. So we've done a lot of work looking at where products are in the system. And we've got around 880 million tech items hoarded away, unused, which could have value, either material value or be donated or even sold. And then we've got over 100 and odd thousand tons that are being thrown in the bin, which are then being lost to landfill or energy from waste. And that whole pile of stuff mixed in different places, we think is around £1 billion worth of material value at current prices. Of course, prices change all the time. That's a significant amount of valuable material that otherwise we have to go and put holes in the ground to get it, which seems common sense. So let's grab it where it is, where it's near to us.
You mentioned it's got lots of valuable materials. What sort of things is lurking in this tag?
It's steel, it's copper, lithium in ever-increasing portable technologies, through to some critical raw materials. Even in small ear pods, you've got neodymium, which is in the magnets, which make the earphones work. And that's the kind of stuff that's also used in wind turbines. So it's a mixture of sort of what I would say the common metals through to really specialist ones. And it's increasingly important that those metals are seen as really critical. There's geopolitical aspects to them as well. But we need to be investing to innovate to be recovering those materials.
So how much can you actually reclaim from all of this recycling? You talk about all the treasures within the earbuds, within the leads. But what kind of proportions are we talking here?
For most small electricals, we can recover around 75% of the materials at the moment in terms of recovering the material. Due to changes in products, older tech used to have brominated flame retardants put into the plastics, and that's called persistent organic pollutants, or POPs for short. That at the moment, because it's considered to be a hazard, has to go from energy from waste. We don't include that in our stats. But for small electricals, you're looking at 75% material recovery. For larger electricals, like washing machines and dishwashers, which are predominantly metals, you're into the mid to high 90% recovery rates as well. So that technology exists. It's UK businesses who have invested doing some wonderful things in recovering that material. And that urban mine that we have of these electricals is going to be a really important source going forward.
You mentioned that the sort of recycling is one of the reasons people don't do it is because of that uncertainty about the future, maybe needing it or maybe not knowing that people need to recycle. What are the trends like here? Are people sort of more likely to know about it now? Are they recycling more? Is it easier for them?
We've created a national Recycle Your Electricals campaign. When we started, we had availability of around 3,000 drop-off points. Working with local authorities and retailers and others, we've now got a postcode located with 22,000 points on. So it's probably a lot easier than people think. We're also investing in local authorities and charities to add more drop-off points. We're adding curbside collections in some areas where that's possible too. And we've been out and about across social and even on TV ads. We've got a messenger, a pink, psychedelic, hypnotic, techno-loving cat who, if you've seen once, you won't forget. And the idea there is just to try and cut through the noise of the world. It's a very noisy world. We're all using tech. It's great, but also let's value it when we no longer need it. It's not just about recycling. We're trying to make recycling the worst thing that we do. Over the top of that, there are things like donations for digital inclusion projects, selling your electricals. I've got teenage children too, and suffering. I hear the pain that you mentioned at the start of the podcast. And our recent research suggests that the average household has at least £1,000 worth of unused working tech that has a value. And there's lots of platforms for doing that. So there's a lot of stuff around here where the opportunities are currently being lost by too many. And we're just trying to make this a normal thing that everybody does, like recycling plastic, cardboard, food packaging and the rest.
Obviously, this offers great potential for your business. Now that the value of metals has risen, how has that affected your business?
Well, we're actually a not-for-profit, so we don't handle the material. We basically enable people to access the system. You do see peaks and troughs when metal prices are high, particularly steel. It's the same issue as the railway tracks, actually. When those core metal prices are high, you get some theft or material goes into different routes. There's still scrap metal merchants that maybe shouldn't be recycling at the quality that they are and would prefer to go to a specialist electrical recycler. So you just have peaks and troughs that feed through the system, driven by the global markets on that. But the good news is that there is a lot of capacity in the UK to properly recycle electricals. And that's the other thing to think of as well. This is tricky stuff. And one product that we've been doing a lot of focus on recently is disposable vapes in the UK, which environmentally are a total disaster. And that's not just a loss of materials in terms of the metals inside of them. They contain copper, which we know is really important for a green tech future. They contain lithium, which we know is really important for a green tech future. And they're also incredibly dangerous if they're in the wrong place, because those lithium-ion batteries, if damaged or crushed, can start fires. And the challenge that we've had with disposable vapes is that they're thrown in bins, they're thrown on the streets, sometimes they're going into waste trucks and causing major fires. So it's not just the value of the material why it's important to be recycling it, it's this knock-on impact on the safety of public workers, the cost of fires to communities, the air pollution that may result from that fire. Search recycle your electricals, clear out that drawer. It's very likely you'll fill that drawer with the same stuff over the coming months, but at least for a day or a week, you can have that satisfaction that you've done your bit.
Absolutely. Oh, for my drawers to be tidy. You've inspired me, Scott. It's been really fascinating.
Thank you.
Well, let's look now at the investment potential for metals and look at some of the environmental, social and governance issues at stake and bring in Matt Britsman, an investment analyst here at HL who's been digging deep into the sector for us. So, Matt, where should we start?
Mining really starts with finding the right place to dig. This can be on the surface or deep underground. From there, the type of mining method used depends largely on where the metal is. Taking gold as an example, open pit mines tend to be favoured as they're cheaper to build and run. As the name suggests, these mines sit on the surface as opposed to an underground mine, where you then need complex tunnels and shafts in place. Now, unfortunately for the miners, precious metals like gold don't just come out of the ground in a nice block ready to be sold. What comes out of the ground is ore, which is basically rock with valuable metal inside. There's then a lengthy process that comes next to go from ore to a final product to be sold on the market. Now, if that all sounds like a hard job, that's because it is. It's also an expensive one too, which is one of the reasons why the mining industry has such high barriers to entry.
Yeah, that certainly does sound like a lot of work, Matt. On that last point, I mean, costs are, of course, one part of the equation when we think about miners' profits. What are some of the other things that will impact performance?
Yes, so costs certainly are a big factor, as of course the price of the metal in the open market is as well. Just like any industry, if you can sell something for a higher price, that's a good thing. But if those costs rise at the same time, then any benefit can simply fall away. A key metric for investors to look out for and track is a company's all-in sustaining cost. This looks at not only the operating costs of mining, but also includes costs relating to keeping the mines up and running, with things like capital expenditure and exploration costs included too. Now, aside from prices and costs, some of the more nuanced factors are things like ore grade. That's essentially how much of the ore is useless rock versus the metal you want to extract. The higher the grade, the less rock you need to process, which of course saves money. And then there's production itself. Miners often have high fixed costs, so when commodity prices are running hot, they want to be operating as close to max capacity as possible. But mines have to be maintained and expanded, which can lead to downtime. You also can't run the mine in the middle of a rainstorm, so weather actually plays a role too.
Yes, of course, and we've had no shortage of extreme weather events recently, which must make life harder for miners. Of course, the environment in general is a broader consideration for the sector too, isn't it?
Yes, in fact, ESG considerations more widely should be an important part of the investment decision for all investors. And that's true for investors who are actively conscious of ESG factors, but also those who aren't. In today's world, good ESG practices are just good business. Now, miners don't exactly have the best history when it comes to this, and the sector comes with relatively high ESG risks by default. Mining produces a lot of waste products and often has a big impact on local communities, so managing those two risks is essential. But it's not all doom and gloom. New technology and a greater emphasis on good practices are starting to make a difference.
Thanks very much, Matt. There is clearly an awful lot going on for miners. So now let's bring in Sophie Lund-Yates, our lead equity analyst, for a bit of a closer look at some of the companies operating here. So, Sophie, first of all, what can you tell us about Barrick Gold?
Hi, Susanna. Well, the name slightly gives it away there. Barrick Gold is a miner primarily interested in, you guessed it, gold. Now, the group's valuation has been lifted to the tune of about 12% since mid-March, and that largely reflects higher gold prices. We've seen a so-called flight to safety in recent weeks, in particular when it comes to investing, because of growing geopolitical uncertainty, and that includes higher levels of investing in assets colloquially known as safe haven assets, including gold. Now, while this is a positive for Barrick, there is a limit to the market's optimism, and that's largely because Barrick is struggling to meet its cost targets. Inflation is tempering, but there's still room for improvement. Things are expected to get better this year, but until there's a clear signal that the worst is over for the group, there will be limited upside. It's also worth mentioning that Barrick also has a hand in copper mining too, which helps diversify things. Essentially, higher levels of uncertainty in the broader market are playing into Barrick's hands. The higher gold prices these are stirring up are helping free cash flow in a big way, but this can change at short notice.
Thanks, Sophie. So that's a big hitter in gold. What about a miner with a different approach?
Yes, so next up is Anglo American. Now, Anglo's valuation has been even more positively affected than Barrick in recent weeks. The elephant in the room here, of course, is the unexpected takeover offer from fellow miner BHP. Now, at the time of recording, Anglo had rejected the bid, but the possibility of a buyout has boosted the valuation. Now, that's because there could be other, potentially more lucrative offers. Now, if a deal is eventually struck, it would massively change Anglo's business because BHP wants some, but not all, of its assets. But for now, while there is no guarantee of a deal, it's important to focus on the business as is. Now, Anglo is more exposed to iron ore and copper, but it also has smaller interests in nickel, diamonds and platinum. Now, from a consumer angle, you know, it might be tough to believe that diamond markets can be difficult, but that's something which has dented Anglo's performance more recently. There have also been wobbles in expectations for nickel pricing. So altogether, Anglo has written down, so reassessed the value of these operations downwards by about $2.1 billion. Now, that is, of course, a tough pill to swallow, but there's a lot to be said about rebasing expectations. You know, it means there's a clean slate to build from, really. Now, the group's also buying iron ore resources from a group called Vale, which will give access to higher grade materials and should ultimately result in lower costs at one of its main mines, albeit this won't happen overnight. Now, the team feels there's scope for a turnaround, but Anglo's current positioning could be deemed higher risk and nothing's guaranteed.
We do like a good turnaround story. Thanks, Sophie. What's the final name you have for us this week?
Now, that would be Rio Tinto. So Rio is very much an iron ore story, which is one of the materials that has very close links with economic cycles. You know, it's used a lot in construction, for example. Now, there are some question marks about demand from China, which is the biggest consumer of iron ore. Overall, the last time we heard, Rio's iron ore business was doing reasonably well, with the effect of lower prices being offset by higher volumes. The group's also accelerating exposure to copper and aluminium. Now, the reason this matters is because these materials are very important to the energy transition. So if we think about long-term trends the miners can take advantage of to try and speed up revenues, you know, the production of components in electric vehicles or energy generation is absolutely a very important one and an area where we see demand being elevated for some time. For now, just to reiterate, you know, Rio's portfolio remains very weighted to iron ore, which means sentiment can be even more linked to economic ups and downs than average.
Thanks, Sophie. There's certainly always a lot to consider in the sector. And with that in mind, let's bring in Emma Wall, our Head of Investment Research and Analysis, who's been discussing the sector in detail with Ned Naylor-Leyland from Jupiter Asset Management.
Hi, Ned.
Good afternoon.
So as we are speaking, gold in recent history has hit a new all-time high. What is it that's driven that gold price higher?
Well, I think the first thing to say is you're referring to the US dollar gold price because gold in sterling has been doing very well for many years. The reason that the gold price in dollars has reached an all-time high is more to do with confidence in US treasuries and the dollar. That it's a reflection really of the market's confidence in local currency rather than in gold itself. Having said that, there has been strong central bank buying and futures buying, but it feels like a long-term technical breakout. The US dollar gold price was around $2,050 an ounce back in 2011 and then in 2020, and it had been struggling to break through that level. Now it's there, it appears to be on something of a substantial and secular move.
Okay, then stripping out currency, why is it that gold has been proving popular? Because it is fair to say, isn't it, that historically, whenever we've seen potential economic or political or socioeconomic unrest, unfortunately like we are seeing in the Middle East, gold does have this perception of a safe haven. Is that ringing true this time?
Well, I think there's an element of that, but it's hard to strip the currency component out of it because really that's what it is. You know, whether you're in Turkey and trying to hedge issues holding Turkish lira or whether you're thinking in a financial market sense about hedging US government bonds and your exposure to dollars, there's always that protection that's coming into the decision making of allocating towards gold. But I suppose you are right that at the margin, some people think that there is an additional premium in the dollar gold price for geopolitical reasons. I'm not convinced of that, but it is definitely true that when things get rocky, people reach for gold and US treasuries.
Of course, I should say that nothing is guaranteed. What is perception of a safe haven doesn't necessarily mean that it is. Let's then talk about other uses for precious metals. So hedging currency, it could potentially be about reaching for a perception of a safe haven. But increasingly, precious metals are being used at the forefront of new technologies as well, aren't they?
Well, that's right. I think it's important to strip out monetary metals from precious metals, or rather identify the difference. Precious metals will include platinum and palladium, where monetary metals is really gold and silver. Silver is very important in tech, being the most thermally and electrically conductive metal, and importantly, the most reflective metal, which means it's used in solar panels, which of course are in very strong and fast growing demand all around the world. So you see silver being used in a whole variety of different applications in relatively small quantities, and in a way that really is invariable. There's not much that can be done to replace the silver in these use cases, with the exception of gold can perform a similar function, but seeing as gold is 85 or so times more expensive, it seems improbable that gold will replace silver in any of these uses.
That's really interesting then. They both have these similar properties, but actually on a valuation basis, which of course is what you're looking at as an investor, silver is more compelling.
Well, silver is more compelling for all sorts of reasons. It's a tighter market. It's not as liquid on a daily basis. Both are very liquid, by the way. But silver is about a tenth of the size in terms of global turnover on a 24-hour period. It's mined at a ratio of around 10 to 1, so 10 ounces of silver for an ounce of gold. The geological relationship is about the same, 10 or 12 to 1. And like I say, its price in markets is 85 to 1. So this does offer a very interesting historical value entry point for silver versus gold. And we very much like it because generally when the two metals are trending lower versus dollars, then silver will underperform gold, and likewise when they're going higher, silver will outperform gold. So yes, it's an interesting entry point on a historic basis, and there's that natural way that the two metals behave relative to each other. Also, it appears that global silver inventories are extremely low, and that demand case is just getting greater and greater. India has imported about 15% of global silver mine supply in the first quarter of the year. So just in 3 months, one country has consumed 15% of all the silver coming out of mining projects. And clearly that's not really sustainable. And we think that higher prices do lay ahead of us at some point in the next couple of years.
I should say nothing's guaranteed at this point. As with all investment, prices can go lower as well as rise. But let's then take a moment to think about how you access these metals, right? Because of course, the two main ways that people play the gold story, or indeed the silver story, is either through the physical metal itself or an exchange-traded product that tracks the physical gold or physical silver, or miners. Where do you sit? Do you think you get as much benefit from investing in the miners as you do in the actual metal?
Well, they're quite different, Emma. Ultimately, physical metal is money, you know, particularly gold. Silver is slightly different because of the above-ground shortage of it. And the mining equities are equities, so ultimately they're in competition for equity investment from other sectors which are, let's say, more popular. They are cheap relative to historic multiples, but what they represent, as far as I'm concerned, is a way of adding power to your elbow or attribution to what is a relatively passive way of investing when you own physical. Now, of course, you know, I like both. And I think that they both have a role to play. But mining stocks have underperformed gold and silver over long periods. They have had shorter periods where they've done very well. But it really is all about what equities are popular within the general world of global equities. And these have not been popular for a very long time. But I think that at some point they will have their time in the sun.
Ned, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was Emma Wall talking to Ned Naylor-Leyland of Jupiter Asset Management. And please bear in mind that these are the views of the fund manager and are not individual stock recommendations.
You're listening to Switch Your Money On from Hargreaves Lansdown. And before we go, there is time, Sarah, for a quick stat of the week, which you'll be pleased to hear about. So With gold, I mean, I think we're spoiled for choice for facts and stats. Did you know, for example, that all the gold ever mined would fit into a crate 22 metres cubed, or that the largest gold coin ever minted was made by the Perth Mint in 2012, and it was 80 centimetres in diameter and weighed a tonne? Or that it's even rarer to find 1 ounce nugget of gold than a 5-carat diamond?
I didn't know any of those things. Funnily enough, it wasn't top of my mind.
You can tell the research has been fun on this one. But I'm going to go with the most common use of gold, which is still jewellery. But what percentage of gold is used for this? And because it's definitely going to be a guess, I'll give you 10 percentage points in each direction.
Oh, dear. Well, you're right. It does have to be a complete guess. So I suppose there's a gold used for trading and for tech, but it does feel like jewellery should be a really big chunk of it. So I'm going to go with 60%.
You're just too far away. Only just, though. The answer is 49%, which is still a decent chunk of it. I mean, there is a lot of precious metal walking around, it seems.
Yes, and speaking as someone who found her wedding ring embedded in the bathroom soap last week, I can now go back to being one of them.
Did you really?
I did, yes.
Lucky that you're all pretty clean in your house. You would have found it for ages. It's a good job that wasn't in my house. There's always the risk that anything that lies around too long will be considered fair game for the eBay pile.
Do you know, I'm not sure they get much for mine. I think we spent most of the wedding budget on the party.
Quite right. That's all from us for this time. But before we go, we do need to remind you that this was recorded on the 29th of April 2024, and all information was correct at the time of recording.
Nothing in this podcast is personal advice. You should seek advice if you're not sure what's right for you. Investments rise and fall in value, so you could get back less than you invest, and past performance is not a guide to the future.
Yes, this is not advice or a recommendation to buy, sell or hold any investment. No view is given on the present or future value or price of any investment, and investors should form their own view on any proposed investment.
And this hasn't been prepared in accordance with legal requirements designed to promote the independence of investment research and is considered a marketing communication.
Non-independent research is not subject to FCA rules prohibiting dealing ahead of research. However, HL has put controls in place, including dealing restrictions, physical and information barriers, to manage potential conflicts of interest presented by such dealing.
You can see our full non-independent research disclosure on our website for more information. So all that's left is for me to thank our guests, Scott, Ned, Sophie, Matt, Emma, and our producer, Elizabeth Hodson.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back again soon. Goodbye.